hardworking, and expected high standards from others. The British newspaper The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. Rishi Sunak has come out in defence of Dominic Raab after the Deputy Prime Minister was accused of rude and demeaning behaviour towards civil servants. The Prime Minister said he did not recognise that characterisation of his deputy and denied knowing about any formal complaints against him. Mr Sunak is facing further questions over his judgment as allegations of bullying emerge from Mr Raab's previous stint as Justice Secretary, with staff reportedly offered a route out of his department when he was reinstated in October. The Prime Minister told reporters travelling with him to Indonesia for the G20 summit, he said, "I don't recognise that characterisation of Dominic and I'm not aware of any formal complaints about him." Of course, there are established procedures for civil servants if they want to bring to light any issues. I'm not aware of any formal complaint about Dominic. Dominic Raab is expected to stand in for his party leader during Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Downing Street said, "The Prime Minister believed that people in public life should treat others with consideration and respect." A number 10 Downing Street spokeswoman said, "While they were not aware of any formal complaint concerning Mr. Raab, there were procedures available to civil servants if they had concerns. There are established procedures by which civil servants can raise complaints. These processes allow allegations to be looked at and considered with due process and a fair hearing," the spokeswoman said. A survey of 20 people working in Dominic Raab's private office when he was Foreign Secretary in 2019 showed that 40% reported personal experience of bullying and harassment, though not necessarily by Mr. Raab, and 75% witnessed it, according to an ITV report on Sunday. The website of French newspaper Le Monde has also covered the same story. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faced new questions on Saturday, 12th of November, over his choice of senior officials after his number two was accused of behaving aggressively towards staff. The controversy over Dominic Raab, who is Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary, came after fellow Sunak ally Gavin Williamson was forced out of the new government because of alleged bullying. Dominic Raab, Rishi Sunak's most vocal supporter in the summer Conservative leadership race against Liz Truss, was brought back into the cabinet when Ms. Truss was forced out as Prime Minister after just 6 weeks in office. Rishi Sunak restored him to his previous role of Justice Secretary, where he had presided over a culture of fear, according to The Guardian newspaper. Some 15 senior civil servants at the ministry were offered a route out to different government jobs if they felt unable to serve under Dominic Raab because of his past behaviour, it said. The Sun newspaper, meanwhile, reported that Mr. Raab had once hurled tomatoes from a salad across a room in a fit of anger during a meeting, which a spokesman for the minister said was nonsense. More generally, the spokesman said, "Dominic Raab has high standards, works hard and expects a lot from his team as well as himself. He has worked well with officials to drive the government's agenda across Whitehall in multiple government departments and always acts with utmost professionalism." Rishi Sunak was already under fire for reappointing Gavin Williamson to a ministerial role despite being told he was under investigation for allegedly bullying another senior Conservative. The Prime Minister also faced criticism for reinstating Suella Braverman as Interior Minister just 6 days after she was forced to quit the Liz Truss cabinet over a security breach. The opposition Labour Party pointed to those controversies as it termed the latest accusations deeply troubling, demanding that Prime Minister Sunak launch an inquiry. With each new scandal and grubby deal, it becomes more obvious that he's a weak leader who puts party management before the national interest, Labour Party's deputy leader Angela Rayner has emphasised.
The indigenous people of Suriname amount to 20,344 individuals, about 3.8% of the country's population. The four most populated indigenous towns of Suriname are Kalinia and Locono, known as the Lowland Communities, and Trio, Wayano, and some other Amazonians who live in the south and are known as the Highland People. During the time of the Dutch colony in the 17th century, the Native American local population of the area retreated back into the Amazon basin. 54,000 African slaves were sold in Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname, to work on sugarcane plantation in inhumane conditions, which caused many of them to flee into the forest. Suriname is one of the few countries in South America that has not yet ratified the Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization concerning the indigenous and tribal peoples. The country's legislation does not yet recognize indigenous communities, nor are there laws about their land ownership. Given the great profitability in natural resources exploitation and the biodiversity of the territory, this lack of a proper set of laws poses a direct threat to the existence of Native Americans of the region. 80% of Suriname is made up of primary tropical forests. The government has granted 40% of the lands to the fishing industry and the extraction and export of oil, bauxite, gold and water.
If they're talking about development, it should benefit the group, you know, who lives in the interior. As I said, you can't talk about development if I'm not in the process. If I'm not a part, you know, of the process, if I'm not part of the management. I have to give you my own perspective, give you my experience, because it will affect and has impact on my life. So it's not that we are against, but we want to be a part and we want to share benefits of all those projects.
In the district of Guanica, the community of Pikimpoika is subject to a double threat. The advances of ecotourism, which led to the decision of constructing a highway through the village, and an agricultural project that involves deforestation. Thanks to the strong protests of the village chief, the highway construction has been stopped, but the agricultural project is still moving forward, and in the absence of a protective legislation for the indigenous people of Suriname, the local community is left without legal options to defend the territory. For years, the state of Suriname granted property deeds to non-indigenous individuals as well as licenses to mining companies, permitting them to operate in the region without consulting with the indigenous community and without obtaining their consent. In the 60s, the American aluminum company Alcoa built a hydroelectric power plant on the Suriname River to supply power to its subsidiary, Suralco. In order to complete the project, Alcoa flooded 50,000 kilometers of forest, which included 43 villages of the Samaka community. As a result, 6,000 people were displaced and had to be relocated in migratory camps. Most of the indigenous people are deprived of electricity to this date.
It benefits only the multinationals because I think more than 80% of all this energy is going to the multinationals like Alcoa, Suralco, and now we have IAMGOLD. So I think it's not benefits the local people, nor the people who were displaced at that period.
Okay, my name is Guillermo Walker. I'm from Coffee Camp. It's about the history of Coffee Camp and yes. Coffee Camp was formed before in the lake they call Van Blommesteyn's Tjumeer. There was before, and they moved us because of the water. I don't know what it was, but they moved us from there and put us in Coffee Camp. Now the village name is New Coffee Camp because we are removed. It was like someone shoot you, you know. They won't give you life. I mean, it's not nice because our maroon people have a tradition. When you live here, people, if you die here, you want to stay there and live with your people until the end of time. You don't want to move and go and live somewhere else. Then it'd be like you lost your, your immune.
Your heritage?
Yeah. So, we want to live there with the people together and die with them together. That's it.
The increase in the price of gold makes Suriname a major exporter of this mineral, but extracting and processing gold leads to deforestation and the pollution of water. Therefore, the forests disappear and the natives are left without water. In small-scale or informal mining, mercury is used to process gold, and in large-scale mining, the companies use cyanide nitrate. The remains of this illegal substance stay in the water, polluting it for years.
Basically, you have two levels of mining. One is the large-scale mining done by incorporated companies, many of them multinationals. They tend to be more mechanized, they have more advanced technology, better efficiencies, and it will often use a cyanide process.
Every year, 60 tons of mercury are discharged into Suriname's rivers because of informal mining. In the community of Apatina, blood tests were run and hair samples were taken to determine the level of mercury in the inhabitants' bodies. According to the results of the analysis, 109 members of Apatina tribe showed great contamination in blood due to the ingestion of mercury. The state of Suriname exploited three natural reserves within the territories of Kalania and Locono, which belong to the indigenous people of the Lower Marowijne, the most important estuary in the region. In 2015, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights voted in favor of the Kalania and Locono people, demanding the state of Suriname to protect their rights by recognizing the collective legal personality of both communities as well as their collective property ownership rights.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Sarah Augustine. I'm the co-director of the Suriname Indigenous Health Fund. Our next point is on the health effects of mercury contamination associated with dumping mine waste. Mercury bioaccumulates in fish, which is the primary source of protein. We've demonstrated in the risk assessment that we've submitted to the commission, which was published in 2012. This research demonstrates the risk that is imposed on the community of Apatina as a result from having a contaminated food supply. We demonstrated neurological impact, including a surge in birth defects, sickness, disability, and premature death in our health assessment, which we've also submitted to the commission. That was routed for peer review in 2013. We've noted that bacteria and E. coli is in the water from high concentrations of itinerant gold miners, those gold miners are operating with inadequate sanitation. So they're polluting the sole water supply for the Wayana people. This is particularly important for children under age 5 who are impacted by diarrhea and dehydration. The impact of mercury is also specifically harsh on the youngest and most vulnerable population. Women who are pregnant are most severely impacted by mercury intoxication, as well as children under 5, those people whose nervous systems are still developing. We have also demonstrated in our health assessments that all individuals of all ages, are actually impacted by mercury contamination from this waste, inadequate dumping of toxic waste. We understand from the testimony of our in-country partners that concession owners willingly and knowingly support small-scale gold mining. This is important to note because often in the news you will hear that these are illegal miners that come into Suriname lands and there's no way to control that. But actually we are told that those people who control concessions in the interior are benefiting from that gold mining and are in partnership with these itinerant miners who come in and do this alluvial gold mining. So we would like to ask the commission to encourage the state to regulate the gold mining industry and prohibit mercury pollution.
Despite the court's ruling, land concessions in Suriname continue. Another example is the planned expansion of Johan Adolf Pengel International Airport. The project involves issuing a land title which covers the traditional territory of at least two indigenous tribes, the Witsanti and Hollands Kamp. Two of the Witsanti leaders were brutally arrested after they prevented airport workers from taking technical measures necessary for the expansion in their village. After the arrest, the villagers erupted in protest and the residents of the area blocked the road to the airport, which resulted in the release of the leaders. The subsequent dialogue with the government has not yet produced any solution. In a previous ruling on the Saramaca case in 2007, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights decided that the states are obliged not only to consult with the indigenous communities according to their customs and traditions, but also to obtain their free, prior and informed consent with regards to development or investment projects that may affect their territory. It was also established that the governments must reasonably share the benefits of such projects with the Saramaca people. Due to the constant repetition of violations against the rights of native people of Suriname, the court also ruled similar measures to be taken for all the indigenous tribes of the country. It also ordered the state to repair the serious damages caused by the bauxite extraction carried out by the Alcoa and BHP Billiton subsidiaries.
There should be social studies, you know, what's the effects and the impacts of those projects. Also, what will they gain out of those projects? If they're going to get benefits, and what is the benefits? Because not only promises, but they have to be sure that it will give them work, you know, it will give them school, it will give them good health care. So we want to be a part of all those activities that the government and other third parties are planning to do and to have in our territory, in our communities, that will affect and that will have impact on our lives.
Following the decision of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, there is hope that Suriname would adopt its own legislation in defense of the territories and other rights of indigenous people, especially now when the interest in biodiverse territories and resources, such as bauxite, gold, water, and forests, is growing.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Nothing can halt Iran's progress. In the field of economy, Iran is expanding its ties from neighboring countries to faraway Venezuela. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard, "The Islamic Republic's vigorous efforts to disentangle its economic growth from the hamstrung JCPOA and its illegally frozen multi-billion dollar assets by the ever-increasing sanctions of a frustrated U.S. regime is paying dividends as its rapidly expanding trade ties bring in far greater revenues. The countries of the region, aware of the ground realities in Iran, where stability prevails nationwide, providing safe and secure investment opportunities, along with the shortest transit routes for international trade, have brushed aside the false narratives of the malevolent Western regimes of a turmoil that tried to create but failed miserably thanks to the multi-million-strong masses snubbing of the thugs, terrorists, and traitors. For instance, Turkey, whose trade with Iran for the first three quarters of 2022 was worth $4.8 billion, a 24% annual growth, according to Turkish Statistical Institute, continues to ignore U.S. pressures. And last month, it decided to increase its natural gas imports from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Pakistan, for its part, imported almost $1 billion of Iranian goods over the past 7 months, while India, which has invested in the Chabahar port for facilitating bilateral trade as well as to and fro transit of goods with Russia and the Central Asian republics, has sensed the futility of U.S. sanctions and announced its intention to resume crude oil imports from the Islamic Republic. Iran-India trade increased by 56% over the past 8 months and currently stands around $1.8 billion. If Iran has inked a $40 billion agreement with Russia and signed another multi-billion dollar accord with China, the landlocked Central Asian states are making a beeline to Tehran for trade exchanges, for help in setting up modern industries, and for the surest transit routes to the international markets. The same tendency towards Iran prevails in the Southern Caucasus, where Armenia, Georgia, and even the Republic of Azerbaijan were the overwhelming majority of people. Despite the erratic nature of the ruling despotic regime, views the Islamic Republic as the source of inspiration. Across the Persian Gulf, Qatar, the UAE, Kuwait, and Oman, whose trade with Iran increased by 70% in the first 7 months of the current year, in spite of their close ties with the U.S., are undeterred in expanding commercial relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is an open secret that it is thriving commercial and political relations with the Islamic Republic in almost all fields that have saved from American hegemony, not just Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, but also faraway Venezuela, where a wide variety of Iranian products have nullified the U.S. attempts to choke the people of that country to death and deprivation. Now comes the news. To the horror of the U.S., the malicious West European regimes and their mercenaries, daydreaming of disturbing the peace and prosperity of the Iranian people, of the auspicious opening the Islamic Republic has made in the hitherto strained relations with Jordan by holding a 10-day trade exhibition that was enthusiastically welcomed by the Jordanian people. Following last month's meeting in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly between Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and Jordan's Minister of Foreign and Expatriate Affairs Ayman Safadi, relations have begun to thaw and indicate bright prospects of growth. The Iranian trade exhibition held in the Al Hossein Youth City suburb of the capital Amman saw 38 Iranian companies displaying their products ranging from the famed handmade Persian carpets to foodstuffs and heavy industrial machinery to home appliances and medicines, as well as exquisitely carved wooden furniture. Meanwhile, Tehran Times reported in a phone conversation with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin late on Saturday, November 12th, President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi call for expansion of infrastructure ties, including strengthening and developing transportation lines in the Eurasian region in line with efforts to boost commercial and economic relations in the region. The Iranian president welcomed Russia's willingness to strengthen economic cooperation with Iran and expanding infrastructure ties, including developing transportation lines in the Eurasian region. He said this will help trade and economic cooperation in the region. In the phone conversation that was initiated by Putin, the Iranian president said increasing diplomatic and economic exchanges between the two countries are important in improving relations. For his part, Putin pointed the special geographical location of Iran and said the North-South corridor is effective in reducing the time and cost of transportation. This transit route will become an attractive route for the world in terms of economy and trade. Putin also pointed to the visit of a 100-person Russian business delegation to Tehran as the third largest Russian economic delegation to Iran and noted that Iran and Russia have many capacities to consolidate ties. The Russian leader also pointed to the October 26 terrorist incident in Shiraz and once again expressed his sympathy with the Iranian government and people and condemned terrorism in any form. The Kremlin also issued a statement announcing that Putin had a phone conversation with his Iranian counterpart. Putin and the Iranian president emphasized the strengthening cooperation in political and economic spheres, including transportation.
Historically, each epoch has a particular industrial growth spurt. At present, what we are witnessing is another industrial shift, but this time it is towards knowledge-based products. These items have allowed several processes in our lives and industries to become faster and more efficient. For example, medical devices such as the hemodialysis machine have helped treat illnesses that were previously lost causes. The development of knowledge-based products is also important for the preservation of the environment and protecting it from harmful matter such as industrial waste. It's hard to imagine what our lives would look like without these items.
Hello once again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar with me, Sarah Dema. This time, we are going to venture through Iran's knowledge-based productions. We will uncover who makes these products and why they are important to all industries in the country. We will also check out how the government is supporting knowledge-based companies in developing new advanced technologies. So get comfortable and let's start the show.
This time, our journey took us to the city of Abhor in Zanjan province, where we visited Fanovaron Zistkore. This knowledge-based company was established nearly a decade ago and is active in three fields of laboratory work, research, and production of advanced machinery. The beating heart of this company is its advanced lab, which is trusted and certified by the National Environmental Protection Agency. Plus, it's part of the country's strategic technology lab network. Its labs are equipped with environmental monitoring technology as well as other instruments to carry out specialized research. Currently, its extensive lab cooperates closely with various industries, including hospitals in the field of environmental pollution monitoring, and acts as a research center for future innovations. This knowledge-based company provides many research services through its laboratories. For For example, it previously carried out research projects in the field of oil refinery liquid waste. Another project was research on the treatment of synthetic resin sewage discharge using synthesized photocatalytic nanocomposites. These are used to gauge and remove pollutants in liquids for purification purposes. This company actively exchanges scientific information both nationally and internationally and regularly publishes its findings in academic journals at home and abroad. It collaborates with academic institutions and other research-based firms, providing them with test results. The government has been shifting more and more towards a knowledge-based economy that thrives on research. So knowledge spillover plays a big role in entrepreneurship, especially in cross-discipline research. Having labs in the country dedicated to advancing specialized research is very important. These types of knowledge-based companies help expand products in the market that may have been previously imported. It was the first company in the country to apply science for manufacturing wastewater treatment and purification. Its manufacturing workshops are massive, with a cumulative area of over a hectare to produce the giant water treatment systems. Its machinery is used in industrial settings where water is refined and returned to the system for reuse. Furthermore, its machinery has helped preserve valuable water resources nationwide. Some sectors that apply this technology are the food industry. In general, all industries that use water to produce their products are the end user of this company's water purification machinery. All of the technology produced here is manufactured along the lines of European standards. Its capabilities and products have been exported to regional areas, including Europe. As part of its future goals, this company wants to expand its product list and increase its exports. It's noteworthy that this company has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Among its staff, this company employs the capabilities of environmental engineers, among other experts, on its roster. Among its many competitive advantages, one can name the high-quality material that is used for productions of its water purification systems. But that's not all. This company has played a big role in creating technology that preserves all the fine qualities of water using advanced machines for purifications. Iran has been supporting the shift to a knowledge-based society by implementing plans that empower companies in their efforts to develop advanced technology. In fact, in 2010, the government passed laws promoting and supporting knowledge-based companies as part of a legal framework. This has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many social and economic advantages. In 2013, there were only 50 knowledge-based firms and startups. That figure has grown over the years to well over 6,000 companies, according to the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology. A diverse range of products is manufactured by these firms to meet the country's rising domestic demands. This has saved the country millions of dollars by reducing expensive imports. Iran makes thousands of different types of specialized technologies. The amount of progress of knowledge-based firms in the fields of medical devices, energy, and information communication technology is the most noticeable. Aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals are among other disciplines researchers are focusing on. And exports of knowledge-based products are estimated to reach over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's based on figures from the Science and Technology Office. The National Innovation Fund says tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. Some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market as well. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. Some of these schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports.
Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever. Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least five mines in Fars province. Esterlal Abadi Company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties. There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has three factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions. Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius. The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-rate fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the research and development department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal-e Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported. Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramic ware, such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries. The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market. Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports compose some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metal sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. Catalysts are the unsung heroes of the chemical reactions that make human society tick by. They help speed up chemical processes between molecules that might have been taking years to interact. Factories rely on catalysts to make everything from plastic to drugs. Catalysts also help process petroleum and coal into liquid fuels and are key players in clean energy technologies as well. However, their biggest use happens in the oil and gas industries.
All right, everyone. Now I will pass it over to my colleague who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's take a look.
You definitely have a clear image of a concrete or a steel structure, but when it comes to tensile structures, you most likely cannot picture anything. They're self-standing structures carrying only tension and no compression. Mostly made of membrane or industrial fabrics, they're most often used for roofs and canopies, creating unique private and public spaces. Mahout is the name of an Iranian company that makes all kinds of tensile structures. Tensile structures can cover vast areas. While they're lightweight compared to other types of construction, they're extremely strong. Tensile fabric structures are designed and engineered to withstand even the most severe weather conditions, providing protection from both rain and sun. Mahout says its products are made using the latest technology and high-quality materials, on par with their international peers. Mahout has under its belt a dedicated team of experts who are constantly exploring new trends and efficient designs for eye-catching yet resilient tensile structures. While the Iranian brand has a strong foothold in Iran's market and is eyeing higher horizons, Mahout says it's working to undertake international projects. Offering a unique landscape for outdoor eateries, restaurants, and coffee shops, tensile structures are beginning to attract more attention in the architecture industry. This means the future market will be lucrative for the actors in this field. And Mahout says it will stand out, as it believes quality is in the details.
There is so much more that can be said about knowledge-based products, so let's take a look at some news and trends in this field. You have probably heard the phrase NFT, or non-fungible tokens, being thrown around recently. The very first Iranian NFT issuance platform was established and launched in the country.
The platform is called Bita. It was created by a company in the field of developing digital technologies in the information communication technology sector. Bita digitally certifies artistic and non-artistic works in the form of non-fungible tokens. The developer says it plans to increase international access and grow the platform's ecosystem to determine accurate asset values. People can purchase NFT that are backed by authentic art approved by the system and sold at auction.
Most people don't think twice about fungi, but what if it could be used to help treat diseases? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company has managed to come up with the technology to produce rare medicinal fungi.
This company focused on producing four species of medicinal fungi. Once cultivation conditions have been established, these plants can be mass-produced. Its medicinal properties will be used in the form of tablets and capsules. These fungi have the potential to treat liver disease, immune deficiencies, diabetes, and some skin diseases. Plus, the four species can now be cultivated in 3 months.
The number of cars and pollution increases as cities grow, and one way to manage this issue is to create specialized technology. Domestic knowledge-based companies and startups have developed 17 innovative products to improve road traffic and reduce air pollution.
The products were developed to address the rising number of vehicles and inner-city trips in cities nationwide. Some of these smart products are used to record traffic violations, collect traffic information, and license systems for restricted traffic zones, among many others. Smart traffic monitoring systems have also been developed by these companies.
We are fresh out of time for our program for today. Thank you for tuning in, and I will see you right here next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Widespread dissatisfaction of employees working for the British National Health Service, NHS, including a significant part of doctors and nurses who are going to resign in protest at the current situation, has put this complex, more than ever, in danger of bankruptcy. The British Medical Association, which has recently conducted studies on the healthcare system, has warned about the collapse of the NHS. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer has admitted the National Health Service is on the brink of collapse, but warned the struggling service will also need to play its part in helping fix Britain's broken economy. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt said there were massive pressures in the NHS, with doctors, nurses on the front line, frankly, under unbearable pressure. However,